mother and father, they came from opposite sides of the world to arrive in America. One from India and the other from Jamaica, in search of a world-class education. But what brought them together was the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And that's how they met, as students in the streets of Oakland, marching and shouting for this thing called justice, in a struggle that continues today. And I was part of it. My parents would bring me to protests, strapped tightly in my stroller. And my mother, Shamala, raised my sister Maya and me to believe that it was up to us and every generation of Americans to keep on marching.
Senator Kamala Harris speaking yesterday after being officially introduced as Joe Biden's running mate. She is both the first Black woman and the first South Asian woman to appear on a major party's presidential ticket. Her mother is Indian. Her first name, Kamala, means lotus flower in Sanskrit. And for many members of the Indian American community, when Joe Biden announced Kamala Harris was going to be his running mate on Tuesday, well, it was a powerful and emotional day.
For those of us who worked on our campaign, and I can't, as a woman of color, as an Indian American, I can't tell you what this feels like. I'm happy.
That's Harini Krishnan, California co-state director of South Asians for Biden, speaking to ABC7 on Tuesday. We're going to talk about what this means with Karthik Ramakrishnan. He's a political scientist at UC Riverside, and he studies the Asian American electorate. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And how did you react when you found out that Joe Biden picked Kamala Harris?
You know, I was actually in a board meeting while the announcement came through, and I found out secondhand through others. And then reporters started reaching out to me by email and text. So it was a big day and a special day in many ways.
Right. And a special day because often Indian Americans are not really considered when it comes to politics. There's not a lot of discussion of Indian Americans.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting is that I think Kamala Harris's nomination for VP, I mean, it's part of a longer trend, but one that's accelerated in recent years. And I think her run for the presidency certainly drew more attention to the Indian American community, and now, making history as the first Indian American, South Asian, Asian American, however you want to put it, to be nominated by either party to the VP slot. It's a big deal.
But a lot of people don't know that she is half Indian American. She identifies and mentions a lot that she's a Black woman. So what does that say to you?
Well, it says different things. So first of all, I think she said this before, the way people identify, I mean, that's an individual choice and a decision. And so she identifies as a Black woman. She also identifies with her Indian heritage and has written and spoken powerfully about the memories and the kind of influence not only her mother has had, but also her trips to India and her family, her extended family members in India have had on her. So I think what it shows is the complexity of race, right? So first of all, you have the legacy of the one drop rule in America. And the idea being that even if you had one drop of Black blood, you would be treated as Black in terms of being excluded from various rights. Now, Harris is the daughter of a Jamaican immigrant and an Indian immigrant. And one might say, well, the same doesn't apply in terms of the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. But that's how powerful the one drop rule is, regardless of one's immigrant histories or heritage. If you are seen as Black, you will be identified exclusively as Black. Now, I think with Harris, what's interesting is that over the course of the campaign, she didn't want to talk about her identity too much. And towards the end of her run in 2019, she opened up more. And I think what you're seeing now is a continuation of that trajectory where she is now much more comfortable talking about all aspects of her identity and not having to hold anything in.
Right. And here's a clip of tape from November, when just before she dropped out. And she is with Mindy Kaling. They're cooking masala dosa. And here's a clip of that.
So we're both Indian.
Yes.
But actually, we're both South Indian.
Yes. You look like the entire one half of my family.
Okay. Thank you.
You do.
I've been telling people we're related already, yeah. So this is perfect. It's basically true. And so were you raised eating South Indian food?
South Indian food. Lots of rice and yogurt, potato curry, dal, lots of dal, idli.
Yes, idli. Mm. That's a deep cut.
Okay. Why was it important for Mindy Kaling to say that not only are they both Indian, they're South Indian?
You know, as a South Indian myself, I'll say that when people talk about eating Indian food and going to Indian restaurants, most of the food, like chicken tikka masala and naan, those are North Indian dishes. So knowing, you know, I think that shows a level of authenticity there. Knowing the difference between South Indian food and North Indian food is significant. And it shows the kind of specificity of that experience. She's not faking it there.
Let's talk about the political power of the Indian American electorate. First of all, how big is this slice of the electorate?
So if you look at eligible voters, these are adult citizens. It's our data. So I run AAPI Data, which is a publisher of surveys and policy research on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. We estimate that about 1.8 million Indian Americans are eligible to vote. And it's particularly important in some of these battleground states.
Enough to sway the vote one way or the other?
Absolutely. I mean, we saw how close some of these contests were in 2016, and it's likely going to be close in many of these states. I think what'll be interesting is looking at a state like Texas. So if you might recall, President Trump attended a rally with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Houston late last year. And earlier this year in 2020, he went to India in a very highly publicized trip. So many thought that this was an attempt to try to make headway in terms of Indian American support. Indian Americans have traditionally been heavily Democratic voters. So this was part of the charm offensive, if you will, by President Trump to try to make inroads. What's interesting that if you look at a state like Texas, the state where they held that rally might actually be more competitive for Democrats now, given that Harris is part of the ticket, because of the sizable Indian American community there and the fact that they've consistently leaned towards the Democratic Party over the last decade.
And in the last election, the last presidential election, did they overwhelmingly support Hillary Clinton?
They did. So the 2016 National Asian American Survey, which I also direct, in our post-election survey, we found that 77% of Indian Americans voted for Clinton. So that, and Indian Americans have been voting for the Democratic candidate, as far back as data exists. There was some talk, some Indian American Republicans were claiming that President Trump would win the Indian American vote this time around. It was always going to be an uphill climb. Foreign policy issues are not anywhere near the top issues for Indian American voters. And a lot of domestic issues like immigration policy, like healthcare, are policies where the Indian American electorate is on the opposite side of President Trump's policies and proclamations over the last few years. So it was already going to be a challenge to try to attract the support of this constituency. But that task, I think, has been made near impossible now with the entry of Kamala Harris. I think it's going to be really challenging for Republicans to make much headway among Indian American voters or among donors. I mean, you saw that record fundraising haul that came in. I think when all is said and done and once the data are out, you're probably going to see a significant increase in Indian American political contributions. Remember that this is one of the most highly educated ethnic groups in the country and one that has, if not the most, one of the highest average incomes in the country as well.
Do you think Trump could do something Hail Mary-ish like dump Mike Pence for Nikki Haley in order to try to win the vote?
You know, I've been thinking about that since the beginning of this year. And there was some speculation about that, in terms of Haley's comments earlier this year, when her book came out, as well as, just Trump being Trump. I wouldn't say that it's a high chance, but I would not call it a 0% chance.
Karthik Ramakrishnan from UC Riverside. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Here to tell us a little bit more about Harris's background, how she grew up in Oakland, and how she got into politics is Melanie Mason. She's covering the 2020 presidential campaign for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, it seems that Kamala Harris's political activism predates her birth. Her parents met at a protest, right?
Yes, her parents were met at a civil rights protest, and she talks quite a bit about how that was a influence that she grew up around. I believe that she tells an anecdote about how at one point she was fussing and her mother asked her what she wants, and Kamala responded, "Freedom." So clearly a lot of time at protests hearing those shouts.
So tell us more about her parents and who they were. Her mom came from India, her father from Jamaica. And what did they do once they got here?
Right. They're fascinating people. They're both very intellectual, academic backgrounds. Her father is an economist from Jamaica. And her mother is was a breast cancer researcher who came to the United States to study from India, which is actually quite fascinating because it sort of shows how progressive her family back in India was at the time to send a single daughter to the United States in the 1960s to study. And so, yes, they were very focused on social justice, on civil rights activism, and that is where they met. And they were in Oakland, California. They were in a real hotbed of activism and conversations around social justice. So I think they were very much both a product of their own sort of academic and intellectual pursuits, but also of the atmosphere that they had settled once they got to the United States.
And her parents separated when she was little, and she and her sister were raised primarily by her mom, right?
That's correct.
And so was there any estrangement between her and her father?
You know, her father really isn't a particularly central figure in her biography. She does talk a little bit about visiting sometimes in Jamaica, but he's been a fairly absent figure. We don't hear from him very much during this time where she's so high profile. He spoke out a little bit last year when she did an interview, actually, I think with The Breakfast Club, where she spoke about, she was asked if she had tried marijuana, and she made a joke about how half of her family is Jamaican. And he actually put out a statement saying that he didn't appreciate that comment. But if you hear her talk about her family and her biography, it is incredibly focused on her mother. For much of her life, it was her mother, and her sister. They were a family unit. They lived together in the Bay Area. They moved for a time to Canada, to Montreal, which is where Senator Harris went to high school because her mother was working there. And so I think that all of the anecdotes, a lot of the personal stories, you really see the influence of her mother as a guiding force in her life.
Interesting. And her mother died back in 2009.
She did, of colon cancer. And Senator Harris has talked about how that experience also has maybe shaped her views on healthcare. And also in my reporting, I've heard that it also prepared her for expressing empathy and for sort of helping people deal with grief. I've heard from people who said that even if she was not a particularly close contact, that she really took the time to reach out to people when she had heard that somebody was going through a loss. And I think that that's sort of a product of when you lose somebody very close to you, you know, how draining that can be, how devastating it can be. And so I think, again, just as her mother was such a central figure in her life, I think that the pain of her mother's death also gave her some of those, informed some of those interpersonal skills that I think has served her very well.
Yeah, it's interesting because Barack Obama talked about that too with his grandmother, I guess, as well, influencing him and his in healthcare in particular. As you're talking about her upbringing, I am struck with the similarities. And of course, she has been called the female Obama, which is, I don't know, a little dismissive, but also accurate, right, in many ways, that they had similar upbringings.
I think that there is a lot in terms of the immigrant background, in terms of maybe feeling like you have to sort of thinking a lot about identity And I think that that is something that you see as a through line in both of their careers. But I think one key distinction is that whereas President Obama was very public in thinking about identity. I mean, he wrote a whole memoir, Dreams from My Father, and talked about sort of what it was like to grow up so much as an other in all of these places that he was. Harris, for the most part, has kind of shown a real reticence publicly to get into this. You know, she will certainly talk about her heritage, her background. And I think that something was very clear from her presidential campaign last year is that her Indian heritage is very important to her and her Blackness is very important to her. Remember, she did go to Howard University, a historically Black college and university, whereas Obama really, I think, relished sort of plumbing the complexities and nuance of that in a very public way. I think that Harris has been more private and reserved about it. It's one of the key distinctions. And yes, they are very similar in a lot of ways, but sometimes it felt when the comparison was just like, look at this other Black politician who's a rising star. What can we do to compare them?
So she goes to Howard and then she gets her law degree from Hastings in San Francisco and becomes a prosecutor. And eventually, we know this biography better. She's becomes DA of San Francisco and California Attorney General. Did she always believe that she could make change from the inside, that it was better to be an inside player than to be a social activist from the outside?
I mean, that's certainly how she has explained her career choices now as a politician. She talks about a line that she often says is that she had to defend her decision to be a prosecutor as one would a thesis. Because remember, because she grew up steeped in civil rights activism, I think that there are people in her life who felt very skeptical of maybe the systems that were put in place. But she often talks about how it was the civil rights attorneys that really sort of inspired her. So people like Thurgood Marshall, for example, where she saw that playing the inside game and using the law as a way to make progress could be the best way to make advancements.
And she married Doug Emhoff in 2014, and he's being referred to as the second man if Biden and Harris win. And he's an entertainment lawyer here in Los Angeles, right?
That's right.
Do we know much about this family that she has married into?
Both yes and no. I mean, Doug was a very frequent presence on her presidential campaign trail. He's very active on social media. And in fact, I think he has quite a following on social media because he provides the sort of behind the scenes glimpses into what it was like on the campaign trail. And even in the last few days, when we saw them being named, when we saw Harris being named to the ticket, he would be tweeting, you know, behind the scenes pictures. He has two children who are grown, and Kamala refers to herself as Mamala. As a stepmother, it does really seem as though that she has formed tight bonds with them. But in some ways, she has also really, I think, protected that part of herself. We did not, for example, see her stepchildren out on the campaign trail for her in the presidential campaign. And so I'll be interested to see if going forward, they maybe start making more of a presence, because, of course, it's going to be their lives, too, that are very much affected if she gets elected in November.
Melanie Mason is a political reporter. She covers the 2020 campaign for the LA Times. Melanie, thank you.
Great to be here.
Coming up, why the House Republican leadership is welcoming a candidate who believes in the QAnon conspiracy theory. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. QAnon is about to be represented in the House of Representatives. Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene won a close primary runoff in Georgia this week, pretty much guaranteeing she'll win in November because this is a deeply red district. Greene has embraced QAnon, which is an insane conspiracy theory that the FBI has labeled a potential domestic terrorism threat. And top Republicans aren't really distancing themselves from Greene's view, which could be a problem for the party later on. Here to talk about this now is Allie Mutnick. She's House campaigns reporter for Politico. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, first, for the uninitiated, what is QAnon?
Ooh, it's hard to explain, but QAnon is a conspiracy theory for which there's no evidence, and it suggests that there's a deep state sort of within the United States government that's actively working to undermine President Trump. And I think the details vary from there, depending on who you ask. But Q is a person or a group of people who are, you know, whistleblowers, so to speak, who have accused, you know, Democratic politicians and celebrities of being part of a child sex trafficking ring, you know, being part of this secret international group that worships Satan, that wants to control the world. There's a lot of different levels to it.
Right. And that was at the root of the Pizzagate conspiracy, right?
Yes, in D.C. That's right.
Okay. So Marjorie Greene, she embraces this whole idea?
She certainly expressed support for parts of it, beliefs and certain elements of the theory in, you know, in public and in tapes that she's made and in videos. Yeah.
And what has she said specifically?
She's called Q a patriot. Q is sort of a big part of this. Is a person or person, you know, these whistleblowers, so to speak, and they reveal information to people on like 4chan or Reddit and, you know, drop secret information from inside the government.
And she has also made some disparaging remarks about Jews, about Blacks, about Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think certainly her belief in QAnon is troubling because it's such a, you know, fringe conspiracy theory and there, you know, not currently anyone in Congress who subscribes to it. But yeah, she's made a lot of incredibly incendiary statements about Black people, about Muslims. She's, you know, suggested that Muslims shouldn't serve in government, that the Jewish mega donor, George Soros, helped the Nazis during the Holocaust. It's opinions like that that don't really endear the, you know, broader Republican Party to, you know, places in the suburbs, right? They lost the House last year because they ceded so much suburban ground to the Democrats. And, you know, if they want to get back to the majority anytime soon, their path is not by admitting into their caucus people who are kind of on the fringe.
And your organization, your news organization, Politico, has uncovered some videos of her making some of these comments. And I just want to play a little bit from one of them.
The generations of Black and Hispanic men, do you want to know what holds them down? Gangs. Being in gangs and dealing drugs is what holds them down. The lack of education is what holds them down. That's not a white person thing.
So was this a campaign event? What was this?
She makes a lot of Facebook Live videos where she tapes kind of direct to camera. They're very long. They go on for an hour. And she just kind of, you know, espouses different views on a lot of things. And these were all, you know, very publicly available. You know, there were many members of Congress who went to Kevin McCarthy, who went to members of leadership and said, hey, you know, we need to make sure this woman doesn't win the primary, doesn't win a runoff, doesn't come to Congress. And they were urging him, you know, from very early on to take steps to block her because they were worried about, you know, how that would reflect on their party.
So where was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on this particular election? Was he supporting her? Was he trying to help her opponent?
So when we first reported on these videos, you know, he said he condemned them in, you know, the strongest possible terms, had no tolerance for them. But, you know, as the campaign went on, he later said that he was neutral in the primary, that he had a good working relationship with both of them. You know, that attitude definitely really surprised and enraged some members who thought that he should be doing more to stop her before she got elected to Congress, right? Any sort of disavowal by him or if he lined himself up behind her opponent could have signaled to outside groups, to super PACs, you know, the other actors in the party to really get engaged that this was something that everyone should be involved in and working toward a common goal on.
So why didn't he? I guess that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So Marjorie Greene has, you know, some support from members of the Freedom Caucus. They encouraged her to move districts from, she was initially running in this competitive battleground district held by a Democrat. And when the incumbent who holds the seat for which she won the primary retired, the Freedom Caucus were instrumental in some members in convincing her to jump seats. And she did have some prominent supporters in Congress. He obviously is, you know, a consensus builder. You know, I think there are a lot of different reasons, but there are certainly people in the party who believe that it, you know, was worth any risk of ruffling feathers.
And ruffling the feathers of the Freedom Party, Freedom Caucus is what you're talking about.
Yeah, or people who do support her. Or, you know, the Republican Party in general tries not to get involved in primaries. They're definitely sort of, you know, stand back, let the voters decide. That's usually the party line. And I think there were a lot of people who really wanted them to make an exception here.
What was her background? What was she doing before she decided to run for Congress?
She's a businesswoman and she's very wealthy, and she was able to use a lot of that to self-fund some of her campaign. But she also, you know, just she had a very big social media following.
And Donald Trump supports her. He called her a future Republican star. So what is his role in fueling the QAnon movement?
Well, a lot of people have said, you know, that he has sort of a, you know, tacit acceptance of it by not speaking out against it. But it revolves around him, right? They're kind of like the crux of it is that there's this deep state working against President Trump and trying to undermine him in Congress. And certainly the people who believe this conspiracy theory are very supportive of Trump.
Are there others who are working their way up through politics who are QAnon believers?
So when we look at the federal candidates running for office, there certainly are some who believe QAnon, but Marjorie is unique because she has a very clear path to Congress right now. A lot of these other congressional candidates who believe in QAnon are running in very Democratic districts, and you actually have a bunch in California. The Democrats running against Raul Ruiz and Eric Swalwell, I think, have both expressed some level of agreement in this theory. But those districts heavily favor Democrats, and it's really unlikely that either of those people win. But Marjorie Greene is almost certainly coming to Congress. So right now, she'll be the only one who, you know, has publicly stated their belief in the conspiracy theory.
Okay, she may get a seat in Congress, but she doesn't have to get a seat on committees. Like, Kevin McCarthy doesn't have to assign her to any committees at all, such as what he did with Steve King, right? He basically removed his committee seats when he made some offensive remarks. So is that a possibility that Kevin McCarthy will say, okay, yeah, you won your election, but you're not really going to have any power once you get here?
No, he said that she'll be welcomed into the conference and seated on committees if she wins in November, as she's expected to. And I think there's certainly people who are upset by that.
Ali Mutnick, House Campaigns Reporter for Politico. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how hard it is to be an ER doctor these days.
The lack of protective equipment, the pay cuts, the furloughs, the working understaffed. It's feeling untenable.
A memoir by a Black female physician, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There's not always a lot of hope in the emergency room. Patients arrive desperate, vulnerable, frightened, some clinging to their lives and not knowing whether they're going to survive. Others come to the ER because, well, it's the only place they can go for medical care, even for minor things like refilling a prescription. For the doctors who treat these patients, bearing witness to all that desperation can affect them deeply. Dr. Michelle Harper has spent her career as an ER physician at hospitals in the South Bronx and in Philadelphia. In her debut memoir, she talks about her experience in the field and how healing patients who have trusted her with their lives taught her to care for herself. The book is called The Beauty in Breaking, and Dr. Michelle Harper joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And you grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, in Washington proper, and you had a pretty hard upbringing. Your dad beat your mom a lot, lots of violence you witnessed as a little girl, and your brother would intervene. There's one part later in the book where you break down and you cry after treating a little girl, and you wrote, you never really cried when you were a little girl. Even though you were surrounded by so much violence and so much heartbreak, I'm just wondering how you learned to stifle that part when you were that little.
And I think it's really common in those situations where, for me, and I've seen that with a lot of patients and children in traumatic situations, where the energy goes to survival. That's just where it goes. You know, I always say that I feel that in many ways I was groomed to go into emergency medicine because all we had when I was little was a snapshot in time. Is this a situation where in this moment, would I survive it? Would my mother, brother, sister survive it? Is it likely to blow over? Or do we have to intervene immediately? And I remember when one day, like any other, when my brother was trying to protect my mother and my brother restrained my father, and during that restraint, my father bit my brother's thumb. And it was a significant wound. And I, to this day, am struck by the brutality of that act, that someone in your own family could inflict such savagery upon a family member and his son. And so I that was one of the moments I learned that there was no safety here. So what I had to do and what I put all my energy into is survival and doing what I could to look out for myself and my family. Mm. So tears could wait.
Yeah. But that's so tragic because crying is part of being a child. Like, it's just so natural to cry as a child.
Mm-hmm.
So in that instance, you drove your brother to the ER, and that was the incident that set you on your path to where you are today. And if you wouldn't mind, can you read a passage from that section of the book where you sort of come to this conclusion that this is a magical place, the ER?
As my brother and I left the ER, I marveled at that place, one of bright lights and dark hallways, a place so quiet and yet so throbbing with life. I marveled at how a little girl could be carried and cut and crying and then skip out laughing, at how a bloodied brother could reappear with stitches in his repaired hand, at how the family of a man who had presumably been fine that morning could manage to leave without him to start a new stage of their lives, one in which he would no longer play a part, at how the man without a home could find somewhere to rest until he, too, would have to go back outside to figure out the rest of his day, the rest of his life, at how all of us had converged in these hollow halls for a chance to reveal our wounds, to offer up our hurt and our pain to be eased. If my brother's body could be patched up, then certainly, in its own time, his spirit could mend too. If we looked, if we named the problem, identified and examined it, then there was the opportunity to fix it, the chance for us to walk out under the stoic pines healed, or on our way to being so.
What I love about that is it's really a description of a spiritual healing. And in a place like the ER, which is all about business and just getting from one patient to another, of pure science, of just living in the moment, you see it as something bigger, as a place where, well, if not you, other people can heal emotionally and spiritually. That is a really interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, and for me, it's the most accurate way of looking at it. I mean, sure, there are the dramatic instances of someone comes in with a gunshot wound to the abdomen and we stabilize them medically, they're rushed to the OR, and then they're fixed. But most of the time, that's not what healing looks like. It's much more subtle, and it has to do with the inner aspects of healing. You know, like the middle-aged woman who comes in with just a dull, aching headache, and she's worried about her blood pressure. And her blood pressure is high, but it's not ER high. I evaluate her and speak to her and ask her, because in that moment there's some time, I ask her, well, we're going to check your labs and get a CAT scan, make sure you're okay. And I think you're okay, but I feel like something else is going on. Like, maybe you're a caretaker. And she hadn't told me that. I know she was looking at her phone and she was concerned about the time she had to spend there. But she mentioned, you know what I am? And she told me how her husband was now battling cancer, and she was taking care of her granddaughter with special needs. So she was under a lot of stress and didn't get to take care of herself. So we talked about strategies that might help her, and she mentioned how she used to do martial arts, and a really helpful part of that was meditation. So while we waited for her results, she said she was going to meditate just to see if it would make a difference. All her tests were fine, and it did make a difference, and her blood pressure was good. I mean, it was ER good and clinic good, and she was ready to go.
But how often do you get to do that, spend time with someone and really find out what's going on versus just treating the immediate problem and moving on?
Right. And so much of it depends on what's happening in the department that day, how someone, the acuity of the illness they're presenting with. But I would say every shift I go in, at least several times a shift, it happens.
And you see a lot of really grievous injuries in the ER. You've seen a lot of gunshot wounds. And I wonder if you could tell us about a patient that you write about, a young man named Jeremiah. He has a gunshot wound to the head. And you write that as you look in his eyes, you see just a far deeper pain than what the bullet perhaps was causing him in the moment. When you were looking at him, did you know that he was going to die?
You know, in the beginning, as he's rolled in, blood splattered, we're getting him undressed, we're trying to evaluate where's the blood coming from, what's the nature of the injury. I didn't know, not initially. He was talking, he was moving, his vitals weren't terrible. But there was a moment when he was screaming out, crying out for help for his mother. And when he cried out that he was going to die, that shifted something. And I looked at him and I knew he knew. We did everything we could. I intubated him. The OR team was already mobilized. So he was rushed up to the operating room alive, but then we got the notification that he had passed away. And so then it was a homicide. But it wasn't until he was close to me, speaking to me, that I got the sense of how that case would end.
And so as an emergency room doctor, as a doctor in general, you have to learn to compartmentalize. You can't take all this home with you, right? I mean, this tragedy, this human suffering and death. How do you do that?
Well, there's many strategies I utilize now. And I will say that I had learned to compartmentalize at a young age to survive. Now I get older, that strategy is, it's no longer healthy. So other strategies I've used is meditation, and I really like walking meditation where I can just clear my mind and hold a space for my own feelings and recognize, you know, there was a time in my life where it was important to not feel, but now it's important to feel and to move through whatever my experiences are and to embrace, accept, and understand them. So that's one of the reasons why I love meditation, or the physical practice of yoga is really helpful for me also. Being in community, especially during this time of coronavirus, where we're all socially distant. And because this is part of my life mission, I say frequently now, I wrote these stories because I really believe that, and I want to amplify these voices, and especially voices that are traditionally silenced. And I want to show that in choosing to heal ourselves, we can be a support system for healing others.
And you wrote this book before COVID, right? Before
the
pandemic. So you don't talk about that specifically in the book, but you did write a Medium essay recently about your experience with COVID in the ER. And the headline of it is, "When this war is over, many of us will leave medicine." Does the us include you?
No, I don't feel like my time in medicine is done. My path is shifting. I want to do more with writing and other projects in that way. Yeah. And, you know, with that piece, I do mean that. I see the toll it has taken on so many of my colleagues. And, you know, on the message boards, on the physician social media groups, increasing discussion about how to leave medicine, the strategies people are employing, what they're doing, because it's feeling untenable what people are saying about the lack of protective equipment, the pay cuts, the furloughs, the working understaffed. It takes a toll on a healthcare provider, on these frontline workers.
Yeah, it seems a lot to ask, especially because it seems open-ended.
Right.
It's not going to end anytime soon.
Right.
And you must be afraid every day when you go to work that you might catch it.
It is concerning. But I think that the only thing that's really helped me in this is just developing peacefulness around uncertainty. And again, I feel that I never want people just to get depressed by what I'm talking about. But in these discussions, I think coronavirus, for example, is just laying bare weaknesses in our society and in the healthcare system and society in general. The fact that healthcare in this country is treated as a privilege and not a right. So I feel like in highlighting these issues, we can mobilize to change them.
Yeah, it really goes to the theme of your book, The Beauty in Breaking. Maybe you're referring to yourself or to your patients with that title, but maybe you're now also referring to us, to America. This is a pretty broken place right now.
It is. It is. And I believe it. And what you mentioned is true. I was referring to myself and my patients and all of us. All of us. And I see amazing potential, should we choose it, for us individually and as a society to rebuild stronger and better.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Michelle Harper, she's an ER physician and author of the new book, The Beauty in Breaking. Coming up, mourning the loss of some of LA's most adventurous restaurants. Evan Kleinman is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, you know what that means. Time for our weekly Cooking with Evan food segment. And good food host Evan Kleinman is here to talk about some sad news, though, this week. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Madeline. Yes, I mean, I don't think any of us imagined restaurants we love wouldn't close, but it's still a kick to the gut when all the closings start rolling in, and we've had quite a few lately.
Yeah, we have. So let's go over some of the, I guess, highlights or lowlights or whatever you want to call it, this, some of the names that maybe some of us will recognize and went to shut down and shut down for good. And let's begin with Tuamek.
Yeah, I mean, Tuamek is, I think, really important. It's important to remember that Chef Ludo Lefebvre, he was the first guy to do a super high-end pop-up. And people thought that he was a little nuts. He just took over this restaurant downtown at night, and he would just make whatever came into his mind. And it was the first time we had seen him let loose from the constriction of very classic French food, and it was marvelous. It was just such great creative food. And out of that grew Tuamek, his tasting restaurant, and I always loved it because it wasn't overwhelming. It was five courses of really incredible, excellent food at a place with a storefront that still kept its previous owner's Raffaello pizza sign. So that's sad, but you know, Ludo still has the two petits toits, one in the valley and one at Highland and Melrose, so we can enjoy him in other times.
So it's sad Tuamek is closed, but it's not a tragedy because you can still sample his food at these other two petits toits.
Yeah, very different food. But yeah. But it's interesting because in also that realm of people who were exploring high-end, what we used to call molecular or modern cuisine, also, we've seen Bazaar from Chef Jose Andres close. And Bazaar, of course, was noted for bringing just a sense of absolute adult playground playfulness to food. It's where you would go and have something that had been drenched in nitrogen to put in your mouth. And so you would look like you were breathing like a dragon. And just a very fun place, and a place where sort of the soul of El Bulli in Spain, we got a taste of that here in LA. And then out of that grew Somni, which was Chef Aitor Zabala's restaurant, who worked for many years with Jose Andres. And that was his beautiful, very tiny tasting restaurant where he sort of stood in the middle at this very beautifully curated kitchen and everybody sat around him at like a super high-end diner curved counter. And so it's sad to see that go.
But when you think of Jose Andres, he has mounted this worldwide relief organization, World Central Kitchen, which is fantastic, right? I mean,
it's unbelievable.
He's feeding thousands and thousands of people. So
absolutely. But, you know, this younger chef, Chef Aitor Zabala, this was his dream and was able to do it with the backing of Jose. And then, of course, Chef Ray Garcia's Broken Spanish is now gone, as is his former BS Taqueria, his more casual place. But he's a real entrepreneur. He's working on several things. So I'm sure we'll see him again some other time. And then Bon Ton, which was Chef Lincoln Carson's, you know, real serious restaurant downtown. He, of course, is one of the best pastry chefs that we've ever had in Southern California. And we've seen him go from place to place. But Bon Ton was the place that he really was able to deliver to the consumer his whole complete view of the meal. Really wonderful food. But again, very new when the pandemic came to us.
Yeah. Well, we talked to him on the show a while back, and he just sounded just devastated that he couldn't keep going. And just the idea of the amount of capital and the amount of energy you need to open a restaurant, it seems daunting to think that they could do it all over again. But is that some of these chefs are talking about? Like, once this is all over, they'll be able to marshal some resources and try to reopen?
I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen. I think that what we're seeing is that really small mom and pop who were already had some sort of to-go or delivery presence are doing, some are doing really well, and some are surviving. But, you know, we should remember that restaurants at every level are closing, you know, neighborhood places as well, and each one of these closings impacts families of owners and employees, as well as rippling out to all the different industries that service restaurants. And I should say that in addition to just the economic investment that it took for all of these restaurants, chefs at that level are like sharks. I mean, they never rest. So it's also just emotionally devastating for a chef to come to a place where he has to just stop, or she has to just stop. I mean, I know how painful it is. It's just the worst, because you're so used to pivoting and bobbing and weaving to make it all work. So to come to that place where you just submit to the reality, very difficult.
Someone who really exemplifies that is Chef Joseph Centeno, who's got a bunch of restaurants. He had to close Baco Mercat, right? But he still has three others that are open.
Right. He still has Barama, which is his wonderful Tex-Mex restaurant. Orson Winston, which is his high-end kind of Italian-Japanese restaurant. And Amasita, which is a more casual version of Barama, which is in Culver City. And Joseph, I think that the sadness of Baco Mercat is that it created an era. I mean, there's no doubt that it was Joseph and that restaurant that made people say, oh, downtown LA, yeah, that's a thing, it can work. And after him came the deluge of both restaurants and development.
Here's looking at you. Another great restaurant had to shut down.
One of my favorite restaurants in the city. I mean, to me, if you're talking about the idea of small plates, a super creative chef, Jonathan Whitener, making small plates that each one is just fabulous, delicious, not gimmicky, but so creative, in a wonderful space that was filled with the hospitality by Lin Ta. It was just a magical, magical space, the place that I always brought people from out of town. That's devastating that it's gone. And yet they still have All Day Baby, which opened right before COVID on Sunset in Silver Lake.
And Lincoln Pasadena, this is one of Christine Moore's two restaurants that has been shut down. She closed that for good, right?
Yeah. Now, Lincoln, Pasadena, of course, was one of those breakfast, lunch, and dinner places, super casual. That place is really going to be missed. Although Little Flower Candy Company still lives on. She has been retooling it to turn it into a to-go only space. And they'll be doing takeout and catering.
All right. So today's episode is not a happy episode. But I guess what we can do is try to support our local restaurants by ordering as much as we can afford to.
Yeah, just be really supportive. Enjoy what's around you. Keep supporting restaurants. There are a ton of them open for to-go and delivery. So occasionally look at lists to remind yourself of what's around you.
Good advice. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. And that'll do it for us here at Press Play today. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.